what happened with the vendor prefixes is that they were supposed to be there for us just to try stuff out. But like, they were there and it worked. And so, and things stayed prefixed for too long. And so people started saying, well, hang on, these rounded corners work absolutely fine. And so I'm going to use the vendor prefixes.
Hello, Spacers. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt, and on today's show, I'm talking with Rachel Andrew. Rachel spoke with us back in 2012 to talk about her book, CSS3 Anthology. Since then, she's continued to work on Perch, PHP CMS, speak around the world, and continue writing about web design. Lately, her focus in speaking and writing has been about the upcoming revolution in web page layout, notably with CSS grids and Flexbox. In this episode, we dive into all those great topics and much, much more. Before we get started, some notes on where I'll be and some words from our sponsors. The CSS Summit is a three-day virtual conference focused on CSS and SAS and the super friend technologies like SVG, Animation API, Design Systems, Preprocessors, and much, much more. I'll be emceeing the whole event for over 3 days. You can pick up your early bird tickets right now at csssummit.com. Uber is giving me the opportunity to give you new writers a $25 credit towards your first ride. You can claim your credit at christopher.org/Uber. Remember, you can set it, forget it with a non-breaking space show newsletter. Whenever the show is ready, you can have a new episode show up in your email box simply by signing up at newsletter.nonbreakingspace.tv. As always, you can find show notes and links at nonbreakingspace.tv. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at Telject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T, where I try to be witty in spite of my own typos. As always, thank you for subscribing, liking, and telling others about Not Breaking Space Show on iTunes. Now, on with the show. Actually, when you pinged me, which is fine, I was actually going through research right now before we talked. I was like, we've had her on the show before. I was like, well, how far along was it? It was episode 8. And I was just like, wow. And we're up to episode 80, 81 right now. So it's so it's been a while, but it's great because I like it when people come back, and because it usually means they'll be doing some more stuff. And I think in your case, you've been doing a lot of stuff since we last talked.
Yeah, I do a lot of stuff.
I think you've written more books than I have. So, which is pretty awesome. Your latest book was for taking over for Jeremy Keith's update.
Yes.
For what book was that? Like, what's the official title for it?
That's a good question. I think it is still HTML5 for web designers.
Okay. Okay, cool. And how's the process for that one?
That kind of works okay, because I think Jeremy and I have very similar sort of outlooks on things. It kind of was okay. It was difficult to know where to sort of make my voice rather than Jeremy's voice. And there's these sort of points where it was very opinionated. And then it's kind of, even if I agreed, it seemed weird.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of more of a writing challenge than anything, just trying to make the two sound okay, and the editors over at Book Apart as well sort of streamlined that a bit and picked up on where it was a bit awkward and what have you.
So what type of updates did you need to put into, like what type of things have changed since Jeremy?
Quite a lot, and a lot of it really was more to do with the fact that when he first wrote the book, a lot of this stuff was really very, very new, and you were kind of like, well, should I even be using this at all? And of course, at this point, HTML5 is just what we use. Right. And all of those things that, I mean, there's a whole section about HTML5 video about how marvelous it would be when we could use it. And just things like that, which needed just update to say, yes, and we can use it, and here's how, and here's all the issues around it. So it was that kind of stuff, really. Just sort of bringing it up to date. But an awful lot of it stood the test of time, I think, in terms of the approach. And obviously, Jeremy and myself are very keen on a sort of progressively enhanced approach to things. So you know, an awful lot of the advice there still stood, which I think it does when you work in that way.
Yeah, it just seems like you just need to say like, oh, well, this is, you know, it works and up in the code and all that stuff. So it seems like a simple update, but yeah. So the new book is out. So you have a new book, and then you Perch. How's Perch? We at E4H, we worked with you guys to do the Perch Summit. And so how has Perch since, I think we talked like 2 years ago, if not more.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether we'd even got launched Runway by then. So we've got Runway as well, which is a sort of bigger version, kind of Perch reimagined for developers, essentially. So it's a bit more of a developer-y version of Perch. For people who don't know Perch, it's designed as a sort of small, simple CMS, mainly for web designers to drop into their projects. So Runway is a bit more complex and for bigger content-driven sites. And we've also just launched Perch Shop, which is a full e-commerce add-on for Perch and Runway, which has really almost as much code in it as the main product and is a free add-on for those products. So, yes.
Wow. So as a developer, what does Runway give me that regular, like that regular Perch doesn't give me?
Right. So regular Perch is pretty much if you've built a website and the client says sort of at the last minute, oh, I'd like to be able to edit this website. Okay. You're going to be able to take your HTML pages and sort of drop a CMS into them. I mean, a lot of people build sites from the ground up with using Perch, but it's very much, here's some web pages. I want to make them editable. So you can add new pages, but it's relatively simple. Whereas Runway is a bit more of a typical CMS approach where it kind of takes over your whole site and has routing built in. But we also have things like collections of structured content. So instead of being page-based, you can just create a whole bunch of content and then reuse it around your site, which I think is more of a bigger site thing, really.
And what type of features are in Perch Shop?
So Perch Shop does all your standard sort of e-commerce-y type stuff. I mean, it has the same structured content template-based approach that Perch does. So you can describe your products, whatever they might be, in any kind of way. You don't have any constraints. It doesn't sort of make you use a theme and just sort of try and tweak it a bit for your shop. It's totally up to you. And, you know, sell things like downloadable stuff or let people subscribe to content as well as e-commerce general sort of shipping stuff, and we have things like shipping bans and location-based tax and all the kinds of things that you get into when you when you say I want to build a shop. It's incredibly complicated.
How long was that under development?
About 8 months development. 8 months. We started off thinking we were going to use an API based service to do a lot of the kind of heavy lifting. And as we went down that line, it turned out that our customers really weren't that keen on having this other service. And they wanted something that was just Perch-like. Yeah. And there was also this situation where if there was any problems with the third party, we couldn't help. It was just like, well, it's them and there's nothing we can do about that. And we hate that. We want to be able to help people. If people come into support and say, I'm having this problem, because we're not reliant on anybody else, we can always say, okay, let's look at that and let's see if we can fix it.
Right.
Whereas we couldn't when we were relying on someone else. So yeah, we ended up building the full thing, which is what we had never intended to do. But it's something we knew about. We'd done a lot of e-commerce in the past for clients. But there's a huge difference in building something that will work for any type of shop than building something specific for one client. So yeah, it's been fun.
Because I guess you're beholden to your brand in some ways, because they're like, we want a shopping solution that's as easy or as fun or as Perch is. And so you have to like, oh, okay, well, it's worth the build it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we tried sort of piggybacking on other things, you know, using sort of hosted cart services and just to give people some way of doing this stuff. And yeah, they always felt like sort of second-class solutions. And yeah, and so it was becoming more and more people are wanting to sell stuff, you know, whether it's just selling some ebooks or whether it's rolling out a full e-commerce store. And so I think, you know, we've got a great solution. There's always more you can do with this stuff. And we've got this sort of roadmap online, which people are giving us suggestions, and we're letting people vote up what they'd like to see us do next. So that's kind of good fun.
So I remember you, I think it was you, make sure, let me know if it's right, complaining about VAT tax and trying to get that set up because they, as an American, can you explain what VAT tax is and what the headaches are involved in that?
Right. So this specifically was the change to how the EU, the European Union, deal with VAT. Essentially, VAT is a sales tax. So you have to, if you sell stuff, you have to register for VAT over when you're selling over a certain limit. And so you have to charge this. It's 20% in the UK. But everywhere in Europe has their own amount that they charge. So like in Germany, it's 19%. Now, it used to be that you always charged VAT based on where you were. Mm. So if I sold something to anyone in Europe and they weren't a registered business with their own VAT ID, because at that point you don't have to charge them VAT, but I would always charge UK VAT. So I would always know VAT was 20%. Mm-hmm. Now I need to charge it at their rate. So if I sell a copy of Perch to someone in Germany, I have to charge them 19% VAT. And not only that, I have to log the proof that they are in Germany, which of course as a digital purchase is really, really hard. Right. I have to have two types of proof to show that that's why I've charged them 19% VAT.
So go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. And then I have to pay the VAT that I have collected from the German to the German tax authorities. And that has to happen all over Europe.
That's amazing. So what are your two pieces of proof? Like if I'm in Germany and I buy something like digitally from your store, like what's the two pieces of proof?
Well, so business address is normally okay. Of course, people can lie. What we do is we collect as much as possible. So we collect their address in their account, which is why you'll find European companies tend to ask you for your address when you buy from them. Mm-hmm. It's because we need to know it. So we do that. We also get the IP address and geocode it, which of course they could be spoofing it, but most people don't. So we get the IP address. And that we then also get back from the gateway. So whether that's PayPal or Stripe or whatever, we'll get back the card address. So we essentially get three bits. And as long as we've got two that match, mm-hmm. we're okay. But we do get the situation where, you know, someone with a French company address is currently in Germany, but they've got a card registered in the UK. We do get three non-matching ones occasionally, but not that often. We can normally get two. So Perch Shop stores that too.
So what's a cascade fight on that one? You have three countries. Which one wins out?
Well, then you have to contact your customer officially and say, have we charged you the right VAT? We always go from what they gave us. We assume that they're not lying in their company address, because right. certainly for Perch licenses, it's less likely they're going to do that. But it is really difficult. It's been an absolute nightmare for particularly people selling. It caught up all these people who like sell a few knitting patterns online.
Yeah.
You know, who aren't really proper businesses, you know, not businesses in the sense that we are, yeah. where, you know, our entire income is in terms of this. So it's been an absolute mess. And other countries around the world are doing the same thing, is the worrying thing. They're basically saying, if you sell to our citizens,
right.
then we want the tax. And I think at the moment, you know, people in America, I mean, so like our competitors at Perch, you know, other CMS solutions that are based in the States, have basically ignored this issue, although they are supposed to. Everyone is supposed to be paying tax to the EU, which of course no one in America is, unless they're a huge company mm-hmm. and would get chased, because like, why would you? I mean, but it's happening. It is happening worldwide. I think Australia are now planning on doing, or they already are maybe doing something. So, you know, it I think this is going to be an ongoing issue. I don't know if you know, but the UK is currently voting as to whether we're going to leave the EU. Right. And it wouldn't make any difference if we did, because we'd still be liable for this. And they'd already know about people like us.
Right.
So, yeah. There's no, it's craziness.
I mean, like, and what would happen if we didn't have the technology to track all that, right? Like, just to track all that record keeping, right? Like, how would small businesses keep up with that? So,
well, it's not easy for a lot of small businesses as it is. I mean, because most of the sort of solutions out there don't really handle it that well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had that in how we sell perch, you know, we've got our own backend infrastructure for selling perch, and we knew about this situation. But even so, it's very, very difficult to get all this stuff in place. It's just another thing that makes it difficult. It's not been aimed at small businesses. It was aimed at like Amazon, basically to stop Amazon locating themselves in a place with a low VAT rate, and be able to then sell things cheaper than companies that are actually in those countries. The idea of it was to catch big companies. What it's actually done is it's really, really damaged tiny companies. And in fact, sent a lot of them to people like Amazon to sell their stuff via Amazon, because if you sell a few eBooks and that's all you sell, you're better off not self-publishing them, you know, and selling it from your own site. You're better off actually going just through the Kindle route or whatever. They deal with the tax.
Yeah, so it kills off small businesses.
It's been incredibly damaging.
Yeah, so it's... Yeah, I mean, politicians, right?
Where's our island of geeks that we can all just go and live on?
And then every once in a while, someone in America brings up the VAT tax for America, like to get our own VAT tax. And I'm just like, just a pain of hurt. It's a pile of hurt. Yeah. I won't go down. So,
yeah, but you have state sales tax and things, don't you, as well? So that's another thing. So.
I have to tell you my story about city sales tax. Which is, so we have state tax, and unless you live in a state, like, unless you live in like four or five states, there's no state taxes, but then you have to pay like, you know, probably like your housing taxes or whatever like that. So I'm not an expert taxes, but this is what you, but my story is that I lived in Cincinnati for a while, and Ohio has a state tax. I have to pay federal taxes, of course, every year. So city of Cincinnati has a sales tax. Right. And so, but they get that on the payroll of your paycheck. Right. So your employer is responsible for paying your city tax. So you have to be employed. Right. So, which is crazy, you know, because you don't really see that you're paying a city's tax until you're actually employed or whatever. So, but you don't really get to see that you're paying taxes. So get paid, whatever, what have you. And everyone usually gets paid direct deposit most of the time, but whatever, what have you. But being self-employed in Cincinnati, and I have a vendor that does my payroll and all my taxes. I don't really, because I really work on web stuff. That's just me. I don't know. So I get a letter in the mail saying, hey, welcome to Cincinnati. You've been here for a while. I just want to let you know that, you know, the federal year happened. And so it's time to pay your taxes, but hey, did you know that you live in Cincinnati and we have city taxes? Like, it's a great letter to get in your mailbox, right? It's like, hey, by the way, and so not many people realize that. So, what you need to do is send us money. Basically what this is. and by the way, we realized you're not in our system as of last year. You're this new person who just showed up. You know, not like, hey, congratulations, happy, you know, congratulations for being alive. I know, nothing like, or welcome to, like, just like, so what you need to do is send us taxes for last year. And so can you call us up and, or no, just not going to call us up, just send us your tax information and write a check. Or if you feel like this is an error, let us know, right? And I was just like, okay, so this is form. It's like, okay, so what do you need to do? And it's like, okay, so what you need to do is tell us if you paid your taxes last year, send them in. If not, okay. It's like, okay, fine. But I lived in a place that didn't have taxes that I needed to send off. So it's like, okay, so if you lived in a place that didn't need to send in taxes, what you need to do then is send us proof that you didn't live here. So basically they said, like, can you actively prove a negative?
Yes. Yeah.
So just like, it's like, so that's where we come to, like, okay. So, and so I called them up. I was like, hey guys. And I got this nice old lady. Just like, you know, I just picture my brain, like white hair lady, just working for, you know, just nice part, you know, maybe job that she gets, you know, 8 to 5, whatever. And she's just like, and I'm here just like, hey, like, how do you prove a negative to the government? And so I was like, well, it says here, and I gave the form number. I said, like, this is the form number I'm looking at. This is what I'm looking at. How do I was like, well, do you have your utility bill from last year? Like, why would I keep my utility bill from last year in a state I don't live in anymore? It's like, okay. Do you have your driver's license? Well, I moved states, and you can't have two states' driver's license at the same time. You have to it. So, and I was like, okay, well, do you have a voter ID? Like, again, it's a federal crime to be registered in two states. So I really don't have my voter card from the previous place I lived in. And then at the end of this list was like, comma, et cetera. It's like, well, what can I help you with? Yeah, what's a comma, et cetera? Because I want to know what other pieces of information that I can use to prove. And so I just mean, I want to pay the taxes if I need to, but I just, you know. But anyway.
That's it. Yeah, that is always it. It's like, I don't have any problem with paying taxes. I just want to know what I'm supposed to pay and that I'm not going to get in trouble for not paying something that I didn't know about. Sure. I got a letter from the Irish government, and for everyone registered for VATMOS got a letter from the Irish government with like some outlandish amount of money they reckoned we owed. It was a complete error, but of course threw people into massive panic. And I think Anna Debenham got one as well, and like I got one for like, I don't know, it was like €100,000 or something like that. I'm like, I've not sold that many copies to Perch to Ireland. I mean, normally my return I have to fill in for each country will be, you know, it'd be like £91 have to go to Germany, and then there'd be like, you know, £3.63 to the Ukraine or something.
$1,000.
It was a complete mistake, but of course just panicked all these people who, you know, suddenly thought they were going to get chased by the Irish government. It's craziness.
Like I would love to pay that much taxes because that means I made that much money.
If I'm getting tax bills like that, yeah.
Oh man, all right, well, we can talk about taxes all day, it sounds like. Interesting podcast. Also just want to talk about your speaker. You are everywhere, by the way.
Yeah,
I was like, you remember like CSS Summit back in the day, and now you speak for at Event Parts. I think you're on world tour for year two, or at least three or whatever. I'm not sure. So
which it feels like that.
Which is great. I think you're a great speaker. I always love having you at Event or Humans events. And so it's whenever I see you around, speaking around your tour and like you're traveling, I was just like, it's awesome. So it's awesome. So anyone listening, definitely catch Rachel wherever you can. So. But how is the life of a speaker like that? Because I just for people who are also speaking, just or like people who don't know, just like how much traveling do you do a year? Right.
I think it was around 30 events last year. Wow. And they do tend to be clustered. So you end up with, you know, you get this sort of, at the moment, coming to the end of the kind of spring conference season, and then you get into the summer and so fewer places in the Northern Hemisphere have conferences because everywhere's expensive. It's expensive to fly people around. And then you tend to get another batch in the autumn. And this summer, I'm actually going to Australia to do Web Directions Code. So I'm actually doing a summer one, which I'm really looking forward to. That'll be a great event. Then there's a little set in the autumn. So I tend to link these things up. So earlier in the year, I sort of arrived in Canada. I went to Montreal for ConFu. And then I went down and did Fluent in San Francisco, and then I went to Nashville, and then I went and flew back to the UK from there. So I'll tend to do them in little batches and go from one to the other if I can, because that makes the travel a bit less, rather than sort of flying out to the States, doing 4 days and then coming back to the UK, which is a bit hard work.
A bit crazy.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of like taxes, like how is international flights and flying in and out of USA and all that stuff.
Generally, I mean, I don't really have, I sit and work on planes, so I get on the plane. I mean, I will like sit on the plane. It's 10 hours to San Francisco. I will do 10 hours of work. I'll just sit and work. So it doesn't particularly bother me. Sort of in terms of productivity, I can still get stuff done. I'm very organized about like having stuff I can do offline. We don't have internet on the long flights over from the UK. So it's pretty much all offline time, but that's okay if you just make sure you've got whatever you need, you know, already on your laptop and just get on with it.
So you have the whole Google on your laptop? Because I would be looking up stuff
all the time. I tend to just work out what I'm going to do. So, for instance, I've been doing a load of work with CSS Grid, so I'll make sure I've got like, the latest copy of the spec, for instance. In fact, I turn them into ebooks. I use Pandoc to turn CSS specs into EPUBs. Which I can then refer to on my iPad. Usually in the airport lounge, I get the latest copy, turn it into an EPUB, dump it on my iPad, then I've got it to refer to.
Oh, nice.
So that I do that quite a lot. and yeah, just making sure I've got stuff offline. That I might need to look up because yeah, you spend so much time Googling otherwise, and then you're like, no, my computer's broken.
Yeah. Okay.
But it is about, I put stuff into OmniFocus under a context of offline and store with it anything that I need then to achieve that. So if I have to get, you know, drag something down off the internet or whatever.
Right.
Make sure I've Git pulled on anything I'm working on and all that sort of stuff before I lose connectivity. So
yeah. So you're use OmniFocus, you're dedicated. Like I try OmniFocus every like 3 months and I just like, it gets so overwhelming to pour stuff into OmniFocus. I think that just, and I just get like, oh, really have to pour this stuff. So I love what it could potentially do, but are you diehard OmniFocus user?
It really suits. I pretty much think in sort of structured data. So OmniFocus works for me because I can categorize and nest things and put things into folders and I have all sorts of strange things when people see what I've got set up. Like my email client all mirrors my OmniFocus folder structure as well, which means that I can never change email clients because it's a nightmare. Like other people search, I never use search on anything. I just don't search my computer because I know where everything is.
Oh, man.
It's like, I'm have this, all this sort of strange structure of stuff and things move in and out of different folders. And yeah, OmniFocus lets you do that. It lets you create a system, with much more than anything else. Does other things kind of impose their way of doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So OmniFocus was the first thing that let me get away from having this stuff on bits of paper.
Yeah.
Because I could actually create the system that I wanted to use with it. No matter how crazy it looks to the rest of the world, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, a piece of paper is so on point because I have so many pieces of paper on my desk right now with all my to-dos scattered all over the place. So oh, man.
Yeah. So. No, I really like it, but I think a lot of people prefer something that's a lot simpler. If you know, but I have so many different projects. I mean, you know, I'll often have 60, 70 unique projects, you know, because I do the whole GTD thing of making every sort of thing that has multiple steps into a project.
Right.
Do
you mind if I ask you, like, how do you have your project set up? Because, like, I used to have, like, set up the home work, and then, but then my, like, I don't know, it's like hobbies, I guess. I don't know, like, and then I would have subset projects of that, and then, but those, is that a good way of doing it? Like how do you have your...
No, I don't tend to make much of a difference between anything that I do, whether it's kind of home or work, because I work from home, you know? So it doesn't, so I use context for where I am is more important. So yeah, so either this is something I need to do at my desk. In fact, I distinguish between like at my desk at home, which has, you know, I've got a nice big monitor, I've got all my sound equipment, I've got, you know, so there are different things I can do there than I can do on the road easily. So even if I've got good internet, I don't have, you know, I'm on a 13-inch MacBook Pro. I don't have, you know, all my recording equipment and so on. So that's a context. So it's more that. So a project might have things in it that I can do in one context and not in another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or it might have things where actually you have to like go and like meet someone, you know, heaven above, you know, actually getting face to face with someone. so it's more, so I tend to have a fairly flat structure in terms of what the projects are and not really worry too much about whether it's essentially personal or essentially work or whatever it is, because it's all life, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I think I'm just still stuck in, you know, 1980s, 70s model of just like, hey, I work and then I have to go to work. But yeah, I love the whole idea of context, because I guess that context is, and I guess I should move that as a priority. I think I'll do that next time. My next 2 months.
Yeah. And good context to have is like, you know, a sort of a context, you know, when you're tired or like, I think mine just says brain dead, you know, it's when like you need to work. You're like, you know, you're sat in front of your desk, but you can't do anything useful because you're just so tired, you're jet lagged, or you're not that well. And I have a bunch of stuff, which is like usually really boring things. So it'll be like going and reconciling a bunch of stuff in the accounts. It doesn't need a lot of thought. Mm-hmm. It's not, it just needs doing, you know, so there's always stuff like that. And so I tend to, so rather than burning up days when I'm feeling really energetic and positive and with it, with all this mundane stuff, I keep that for the days when, yeah, I just don't feel so great. And also that stuff you tend to be able to pick at, you know, you sort of sat in a cafe waiting for someone to turn up for a meeting, you can often pick at that sort of stuff and get bits knocked off.
Oh, nice. Okay. So there's a brain dead option.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. It's really useful because there's always that stuff and you can sort of put it there for.
Okay. That's awesome. That's a great tip. I expect the OmniFocus book any minute now.
I think only for OmniFocus with people with brains like mine, which is probably not, it's probably a very, very specific audience.
I guess that's me. And I guess that's all right. But I want to write as many books as you can. So definitely want to talk about, you've been doing a lot of talks about the new CSS layouts, CSS grid, and CSS flexbox. And so I have notes. CSS grid and CSS flexbox. Are there any types of new specs that are being worked on right now of that deal with layout that we should be concerned about?
I mean, those are the main two. And alongside that, there's a spec called Box Alignment Level 3, which essentially takes the alignment stuff out of Flexbox, and then it can be used in other places. So grid's actually one of those places that it's going to be used in. So, you know, all the nice alignment stuff, being able to vertically align things, being able to space things out, all of that stuff is part of the Box Alignment module.
So basically, we're going to take Flexbox and push it into Grid. Is that pretty much it?
A lot of the stuff, yeah. I mean, there's actually in the Grid spec, there is a note saying that, you know, if there are differences between Flexbox and this kind of behavior, that's probably a bug. Because really, I think what people are going to find is if they've got a solid understanding of Flexbox, they'll find a lot of the Grid stuff relatively straightforward, very similar ways. I mean, even things like the fraction unit stuff we have in Grid, works very similarly to how like Flex Grow and Flex Basis behave in Flexbox. You know, so I think having that understanding, and when I workshop this stuff, I teach Flexbox first. I can then directly refer on and say, okay, so you know how this works. And so in Grid, it's the same. It's just that it's two-dimensional now. You're working in rows and columns at the same time. So there's obviously new stuff that deals with that. But yeah, there's a lot that's the same, and that's, but you know, we've got this sort of modular system now of specifications, so we can say, well, this is how we're dealing with alignment, and this is how we're dealing with, you know, content distribution, and any specs that come along should be working in the same way rather than everything having its own special way of doing things.
All right. Okay. All right. I guess we should back up just 1 second then. Is this, to say, what is the difference between grids and Flexbox? Like, what would you say?
It's essentially whether you're working in one dimension or two. So Flexbox works in one dimension. You're either laying things out in a row or you're laying them out in a column. And the sort of obvious example of that is, you know, if you lay things out in Flexbox and you've got, I don't know, sort of like three things, and then it wraps, and then you've got two things on the next line, and they kind of split the content, and you end up, you can't line them up underneath the other ones. That's because you're essentially working in a line at a time. So the content distribution happens over that line. Whereas with grid, you're creating a two-dimensional grid and then you're putting content into it. And so you've got control of both rows and columns at the same time.
So the horizontal and the vertical.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And it's kind of, and the other way to think of it is Flexbox is very good if you want to let the content kind of control the sort of spacing. So you're saying, oh, I've got a bunch of navigation items and what they're all different lengths, but I just want the space between them to be the same. Mm-hmm. You know, for that to be evenly spread out. Now, Flexbox is great at that because you can kind of work from the content out. Whereas with grid, you're sort of saying, this is my grid. And the content, if you just flow it into the grid, it's just going to go sell, sell, sell. And then, mm-hmm. you know, and you've got a sort of control over the major grid, but not so much over the individual bits of content unless you start manipulating them and saying, oh, you need to span two or whatever. So there's kind of a couple of different reasons why you'd use one or the other. I think in reality, as once we get our hands on both as a sort of system, we're going to be finding, you know, as we go along, which is best for different jobs.
I guess I'm kind of floored because like Flexbox was, you know, where I remember Tab, you know, back in the, you know, when he was talking about Flexbox, he would just say like, you definitely just do want to use it just for menus, you know, like photo galleries and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then, but I think Flexbox is out of the gate is supported by more browsers right now, right?
Oh yeah. Well, that's it. We don't have grid support out from behind a flag yet. And yeah. It's a shame the two couldn't have come along mm-hmm. together. I think the thing is that when grid lands, it's going to land pretty much cross browser because everyone's implementing and they're all, you know, and you can try out all the examples I've got for grid, you know, you can try them out in different browsers and they'll, you know, once you've enabled the flag, they'll work. So I think unlike Flexbox sort of came out in bits and it changed and it was all really hard work because then you've got several versions of Flexbox and which one am I working with? And oh, that's horrible. That isn't going to happen with grid because all the changes have happened behind the browser flags. I mean, it's changed massively. And if you just go back through like my old blog posts, you'll find all the different syntax and all the different ideas and where things were added. But that's all happened sort of away from people using it in production. So, I mean, it really goes down to the developing with vendor prefixes or developing behind browser flags. You see the difference of those two approaches with the stories of Flexbox. Right.
Yeah, I just bring it up because I'm worried that we might just about people using Flexbox to lay out whole entire pages.
Yeah, I think we're going to see that. And I think that what will happen is once people actually get their hands on grid and what happens when I workshop this stuff and I, you know, that most people have encountered Flexbox, they understand some of it, you know, and we sort of go through everything. Then when I show them grid, they're like, oh yeah, you know, that's the missing bit. This is the missing layout thing that it solves the things that Flexbox doesn't because it does the things that Flexbox hasn't been designed to do. And at the moment, people are trying to hack their way around the things that Flexbox isn't designed to do.
Does Flexbox solve the problem of positioning elements like vertically, like centrally in a center, like you know, just putting things in a center? Is that the solution that we have, like that's going forward? Like,
well, both, and those things are what's defined in box alignment. So ultimately, mm-hmm. other types of layout could do the vertical centering thing. There's no reason why it needs to be only Flexbox and grid. Right. But yeah, you can do exactly the same as you can do with Flexbox, you know, with align and align content and justify content and so on to center things properly from every direction.
Right. So there's no need to like do all these big hacks. We just like, oh, Flexbox. We just...
No, it really does make such a difference when you, I mean, I prototype using grid quite a lot and then I just rebuild it. Because it's just so nice to be able to easily like move things around, see how they're going to work responsively. I think the other thing we're going to find is that we are far less reliant on media queries and on kind of specifically worrying about where things are at different breakpoints because both Flexbox and Grid are kind of responsive by default. That's how they work, you know. So already with Flexbox, you know, you just sort of say, you know, space between just for items and everything spreads out and you don't have to think, oh, at narrow breakpoint, should I change that value? Because it just works and it's responsive. And so that's the same with grid. You know, you're able to align items and groups of items and things.
Right. So, but like to do media query less responsive design, like, so that's...
Oh, yeah, very much so, I think. And I think you can already do that quite a bit with Flexbox if you're sort of careful. A lot more again with grid. There's loads of ways to, you know, you can have grid tracks that change in quantity depending on how wide the browser window is, for instance. You don't need to use media queries for that. So yeah, there's loads of cool stuff, because these things have come about since responsive design was a thing. Yeah. They're in that world.
One of the things that Jen, someone starts promotes, is trying to get away from the kind of boring, bland, if I could put words in my mouth, kind of layouts that we see every day, or that, you know, just, you know, there's always that thing right now going with like how layouts are, you know, which layout, mobile layouts are you using? Are you using the one with big pictures, or are you stacking content with maybe two things side by side or whatever, and that's it, you know? And with, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, and to a point, that's a really kind of generic website, but what's it looking? But it's hard to, you know, build for so many devices and have things be consistent without relying on, you know, 45 degree angle, like 90 degree angles, and trying to.
Yeah, and I think it's understandable. I think there's this sort of reliance on frameworks and things, because actually layout at the moment is really hard because we're trying to use things that were never designed for what we're using them for.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people say to me, oh, you know, oh, should I use display table, or should I, it seems like a hack. I'm like, it's all a hack. It is all a massive hack. Anything that you're doing for layout at the moment is hacking things that were never designed for that. So use the things that work. And we're getting into a better place, you know. Yeah. Use things that don't cause anyone any problems, you know. Don't create an inaccessible mess, but do what works, and then, you know, overwrite it as we're going forward with Flexbox and with Grid, and you know, use the cool stuff. And I think, you know, give it a couple of years, we're going to be able to start having, you know, say very simple layouts, which we then enhance with Flexbox and Grid.
Right.
You know, so I think things are getting better, and browsers update so quickly now. We're in a much better situation than we were.
Right. Well, that's one thing. As an author, I want to ask you, like, how do you handle, like, because back in the early days, we would just say, like, hey, Netscape 4 supports XYZ. Do you just even bother, like, saying which browser supports what, or?
No, because I think as well, I think that's kind of an outdated way of looking at things anyway. Yeah. I don't think, in a sort of a world of evergreen browsers, you can't be assuming that this will have or that will have support for anything. It's best to assume that, you know, there are going to be things that don't, there are going to be things that do. Test for it. I mean, we've got at supports, a lot of browsers now support that. So you can do essentially like modernizer type stuff directly in your CSS. And certainly for things like Grid, there's not going to be a browser that supports Grid and doesn't support supports. So you can use that to test. And if you've got Grid, well, then you can do Grid things. And if you haven't, well, then whatever you've used before, that'll come into play. And I think that's how you need to think about building. We're very, very much past this, I'm targeting X browser. And I think the quicker people can really get away from thinking like that and just think about making the best experiences for whatever device someone's got in front of them. And that's, you know, that's the way to go.
I think you may have mentioned that. Like, when do you think CSS Grid's going to be stable?
Well,
we think with it.
Well, essentially, I think what's really happening is that because of the way Flexbox developed and got out there and then changed, no one wants another one like that.
Just like that. Yeah, I know.
So I think really what we're waiting for is for the spec to essentially be finished and not going to have any more changes. I think that's fairly close. And then browser vendors are going to feel confident to ship their implementations, which, you know, if people haven't looked, you know, if you know enable the experimental web platform features flags, or download, you know, like the Safari technology preview or whatever, you know, it's all there. You can play with it. You can do all sorts of stuff. So I think it won't be too long once it's sort of declared pretty much, you know, there, and they can feel confident.
So is feature flag the replacement for vendor prefixes?
Yes, essentially, yeah.
Okay. So just and the feature flag is just, you go into your browser and you just turn on the feature. Is that pretty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, generally, I mean, like in Chrome, for instance, there's experimental web platform features, and you just turn on all the new stuff. Mm-hmm. And that'll be in regular Chrome. If you want the really, really new stuff, if you download Canary, you get the really new stuff. Right. So things get into Canary first. And then if they don't like explode in a shower of sparks, they'll end up in Chrome. Yeah, you know, so there's a load of stuff then that gets in there that you can have a look at. And I mean, that's the thing I keep telling people to do, because only by looking at that stuff while it's in development, that's when you get the chance to feedback. And, you know, the CSS Working Group have moved their issue tracking and their discussion of issues to GitHub now. Right. So anyone can go along to GitHub if they're interested in the spec, like Grid, and raise issues against it and say, hey, you know, have you thought about this, or this is happening? You know, most of the browsers now, you know, they've got bug trackers that you can go along and you can actually log a bug against the browser and its implementation of something. You know, whether that's something brand new or something that's been around for a while. So that's kind of, we can all make the web a bit better. And I encourage people to do that, really.
Awesome. Yeah, I always get concerned because I feel like, my concern is this, that vendor prefixes just allow for people who might not. I think it's people just got used to using vendor prefixes as a way of testing out and using latest features, and they might not be so aware of how to turn the flag off, the vendor flag, and stuff. Because like, I know, yeah, I've done it once or twice, maybe, and I'm usually kind of a stickler because I want a browser that everyone else has. I don't want a browser. I'm okay to use extensions and stuff like that, but I want to surf the web that people have that are using right now, just so I know what they're using. And so, which I probably should not. I probably should just have, like, you know, I should probably just have the latest Canary and just, you know, just ride that high of have my browser explode with fireworks, you know, somewhere.
I think that is the problem with the what happened with the vendor prefixes is that they were supposed to be there for us just to try stuff out. But like they were there and it worked. And so, and things stayed prefixed for too long. And so people started saying, well, hang on, these rounded corners work absolutely fine. And so I'm going to use the vendor prefixes and put them into production code. And the problem with that then is when anything changes, it's breaking production code. And people are then upset because, oh, you know, Chrome has broken my site because they've changed how Flexbox works or whatever. And it's like, well, these things are still in development. You know, they're not finished yet. So this is the thing with putting things behind a flag. But then you have this, this problem where people then don't try them out. You know, Grid has been available in Chrome and in Opera, you know, in Blink for about, over 3 years, I think, now. You know, I've got examples that go about years. But I was the only person talking about it for a very, very long time. It's only sort of recently that, you know, other people have started going, oh yeah, this is quite cool. And there's which is great, because then we get more people looking at it. But for a long time there was really nothing. I've had Google alerts on people talking about Grid for as long as because that's what I do. If I'm interested in something, I'll set up, you know, Google alerts and see what people are saying and new articles and things. And there was nothing. It was I'm like, this is so exciting and no one is talking about it.
So you were the canary in the coal mine then. So,
I don't know, someone crazy banging their head against a wall, but that's kind of my place.
Awesome. And I will say, like, you have an ebook about Grid's layouts, right?
Is that, yes. Yeah.
Okay. You have an ebook about it, and then you also have a course.
Yes. Well, I mean, generally about layout. I mean, I've always been fascinated by layout generally. Okay. It goes right back. I when I was sort of early days of the Web Standards Project, the reason I became part of the Web Standards Project was to be part of the Dreamweaver Task Force. So I was interested in, I still am really, in how you visually present this stuff and how you let people build for the web without writing code and without writing CSS. And that was all interested me in Dreamweaver. I mean, as strangely as the code would end up, you know, it was just sort of interesting how you do that. And I think actually Grid gives us a lot of possibilities in that area as well. So,
okay. Awesome. Yeah, definitely. So definitely check out the books and e-course if you are interested in learning more, because Rachel is a great speaker. She's a great writer. So, but yeah, I think, Is there anything else we should talk about, like, that you're awesome at? Because I feel like...
I'm not awesome at getting enough sleep. That's something I'm not awesome at.
Well, you also run a lot, too, which is great, because I do not run at all. And I feel like I always see your photos of you running, and I think that's an inspiration for me to not be at my desk so as much as I possibly.
Well, that's what I do. Because I travel. I go to these places for, you know, 2 or 3 days sometimes. And I would only ever see the airport, the hotel room, the conference center, except that I get up at 5 in the morning and I go for these runs and I take photos. So I run around all the tourist attractions and take photos. So I get to see something of where I've been.
Okay. Well, I'm just curious, like, if you're okay, just how did you get started running?
It was actually the Couch to 5K was the original thing. Because I did dance. I'm an ex-dancer. And so really at school, I didn't do any sport or anything. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty convinced I couldn't run. And so I was well into my 30s before I started running. And, you know, I've now done a marathon and I run half marathons fairly regularly. It's a nice thing to do if you haven't got a lot of time, because you can stick your shoes on, you can go out for half an hour or so, and then be back, you know, in the shower and at your desk. You can be out for just an hour. Yeah. Whereas if you go into the gym or something, it's a bit more of a hassle, you know. A lot of people have to drive to the gym and, you know, and it's like, it's expensive. So running's great because you can do running everywhere. You don't have to go in the hotel gym, which has been put together by someone who saw a picture of a gym once. Yeah. Oh my word, hotel gyms. Yeah. And okay, you get to see places. So.
Cool. Yeah. And Josh Clark is the one who started the Catch 5K.
Yeah. Well, that's so cool. Yeah. We were at Event Park Boston, and Josh Clark was there, and Drew runs as well. And Drew had come to Event Park with me. Drew had a photo of Josh and was like, oh, you know, Josh was the Catch 5K, because so many people we know who aren't related to the web, that's how they got started running, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's awesome. I'll be focused. I have failed Couch 5K so many times. So so I'm going to try it again. So, but yeah, cool. Awesome. And then, your inspiration. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Well, it's been fun.
Cool. Awesome. And where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Rachel Andrew. And I'm Rachel Andrew most places. So my personal site is rachelandrew.co.uk, and you can find links from there really to everything that I'm currently up to.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Good speaking to you.